from ACV Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. Over the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to persons who are blind or visually impaired. Now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. This is Paul Edwards in Miami, Florida. I'd like to thank my producer, Brian Charlson, as well as our recorder-editor, Steve Bauer, for all of their help with Tuesday Topics. Without their assistance, Tuesday Topics would certainly not be as successful as I hope it is. Also, of course, we'd like to thank George Bies of Talking Communities for the work that he's done in making the software that we use for recording this program available to us. Thank you, George. Without you and without Talking Communities, this program wouldn't be happening. So we very much appreciate your efforts, sir. Well, I knew it was going to happen one evening or another. All of the people who had been scheduled to be a part of this program, and there were actually several, for a variety of reasons are not able to be with us this evening. And as a result, at least until some others turn up, and hopefully some will, I'm going to end up talking to you a little bit about the issues that this program will consider. And those issues are emergencies and evacuation and some of the other concerns that are out there for those of us who are blind or visually impaired. To begin with, I want to start by suggesting that this is an area that there are very few communities in this country who handle well. That is, all of the discussions that I've had with people with disabilities concerning emergency preparedness suggest that communities have an awfully long way to go to get to the place where they have plans that really do meet the needs of people with disabilities. And that's not only my opinion. It really was borne out 3 years ago when Katrina happened, but it's also been borne out in virtually every major disaster that has occurred where we've looked hard at how people with disabilities are treated in these kinds of situations. It's also perhaps reiterated, and the proof exists, in the fact that the Department of Justice, which under this administration is a notoriously and absolutely conservative entity in my view, has seen fit to prepare a number of documents that directly relate to emergency preparedness. And in fact, it was the appearance of those documents earlier this summer that led me to put this topic on our list, because I want to draw people's attention to the fact that there now are some pretty effective documents available that people can look at and can encourage their communities to look at as well, that will make it considerably easier for communities to develop more meaningful and effective emergency preparedness plans. By the way, I'm happy to tell folks that we actually do have some folks who've joined us now, and that's exciting. We'll get to those folks a little bit later after I've laid some of the foundation, and hopefully they'll have some questions or comments that will enrich our presentation a little bit. The documents that the Department of Justice has published can be found at a place called www.ada.gov. And this is a website that I would urge everybody to become more familiar with anyway, because it's a website that gives people access to all kinds of appropriate information about the Americans with Disabilities Act. It includes, among other things, a relatively new approach that the Department of Justice has attempted to apply to Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Title II, many of you will remember, is that part of the Americans with Disabilities Act that covers state and local government. And so it is the segment of the ADA that essentially sets out the rights that people with disabilities actually have in their communities. And what the Department of Justice has done over the past year is to publish what they describe as an ADA toolkit. And the ADA toolkit is essentially a series of about 18 documents that have been published and are available as either HTML or PDF files, though we'll talk in a moment about the nature of their PDF files. But they are HTML or PDF files, which are intended to provide state and local government entities with ideas about how they can come into compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. There are 7 chapters in the toolkit, and each of the chapters, in addition, has what's called a checklist attached to it. So, in addition to the chapter that outlines what it is that the community is supposed to do in various areas, there is also one or more checklists that directly relate to those tasks that a community can actually use in order to see just how far it's gotten with complying with the components that are listed there. And Chapter 7 of that toolkit, the very most recent one to be developed, and one that only came out at the beginning of this summer, is a toolkit on emergency preparedness. And it actually has a couple of checklists, or 3 checklists, and an introduction to those checklists. It's actually pretty exciting because it's a relatively short document, Chapter 7 is, but it does touch on most of the high points. It's not written in legalese. It's pretty straightforward. But it does make clear, I think, though its tone is kind of advisory and friendly, but it does make clear what kinds of steps it's expected that communities will actually take. Part of the problem that's existed with emergency preparedness in the past, and this applies to earthquakes as much as it does to tornadoes in the Midwest or hurricanes on the East Coast or potential evacuation because of some sort of terrorist attack or a chemical spill or a gas leak, all of which are appropriate kinds of disasters that may in fact occur in a community. But part of the problem in the past is there was very much a shove the disabled people aside tone to the way that virtually all communities handled people with disabilities. They were an extra bother, or we were an extra bother, and there was an expectation that either families would take care of people with disabilities or else they would be shunted out of the way to an area that may well prove to be one of the least appropriate for people with disabilities. So one of the things that would typically happen in emergency evacuation scenarios is all disabled people would be told, well, you got to evacuate very early, and you've got to go to a hospital, or you've got to go to a location that's especially designed for you people. You can't be integrated with the rest of the community because it's inappropriate to expect that folks who are manning the shelters and who are running the shelters for us, like the Red Cross, would know how to deal with you. Well, there are a lot of us who are disabled who didn't appreciate that kind of treatment and who felt that we were entitled to better. We didn't feel that we needed necessarily to be evacuated to a hospital. Some of us perhaps didn't even feel that we needed to be evacuated. But essentially, we were told, as so many folks were told in Louisiana a couple of weeks ago, if you don't evacuate when and where we tell you, you're on your own, and we're not going to provide you with any help. And brutal though that is, that was often the way that emergency preparedness systems treated folks. And while I certainly appreciate much that the Red Cross does, I need to tell everyone that in my view, the Red Cross is as much of a problem as it is a part of the solution, because the Red Cross itself really didn't want to have very much to do with integrating people with disabilities into their shelters.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Well, let's take a break from my lecturing for a few minutes and see who has joined us and whether they would care to participate in the discussion. Do you guys have any questions so far about any of the issues that I've raised?
Hello, Paul. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I don't know if it's so much a question as an observation. Like, you know, if you recall, or anybody recall, over the years when we had the fire drills in schools, like I went to school with mine, where we all went outside and then we went back in when it was okay. And then I did that at the rehab center in Kalamazoo. But when I was working, I did that too with them. But one time they had me wait until everybody else left, and then they had me stay there until everybody else left, and then I guess they took me out, if I recall. It seemed like they just had me staying in the building while I got some help afterwards.
What do you think of that approach, Gary?
No, I don't really care for it. I'm capable of going outside as well as anybody else who is so-called, normal or that are not handicapped.
One of the components of emergency evacuation, as it's being practiced, does apply to precisely the kinds of situations that you're talking about, whether they relate to terrorism or whether they relate to a chemical issue, where you do have to evacuate large buildings. One of the things that we found difficult to do with regard to, say, a college, is to develop an emergency evacuation plan that actually did meet the needs of people with disabilities. And the couple of times when they've been tested, things have not always worked as well as they could have. I mean, there are times when they've worked well. We've now actually worked on developing what we think will be a better plan. But the core of that plan is providing good training. Most emergency evacuation plans of buildings now focus on the creation of areas of refuge, and these are areas where the building is strongest and where people with disabilities are actually encouraged to wait, and where fire marshals and security officials are supposed to check. They often are stairwells in multi-story buildings because those are the last elements of a structure that are likely to have difficulties. And there are now beginning to be signs in buildings that direct people to areas of refuge. And one of the things that we need to begin to do is to start training people who are blind and visually impaired. If they can't find someone to get out of a building with, to take the time to learn where those areas of refuge are so they can optimize the likelihood of their being carried to safety. Many emergency evacuation plans in buildings are now incorporating specialized equipment for getting folks who use wheelchairs off higher floors by moving them down the side of the building in special harnesses, or where it's appropriate by using stairwells to get people down to the ground floor, often abandoning wheelchairs in place, because this is in fact the most appropriate way of dealing with those devices, in that many of them are very heavy and are electric and simply can't be carried with the individual. So a lot of buildings, particularly Title II structures, are now acquiring special devices that are designed for emergency evacuation that enable security personnel to actually transfer a wheelchair user into that device for evacuation. So the point that you make, though, Gary, is a well-made one, because it focuses attention on the fact that very often, especially when there is a disaster, unless there really is training and unless there's care out there, people kind of forget about folks with disabilities. They're more concerned about getting out themselves. We certainly heard of lots of instances of heroism on the part of people without disabilities in helping folks with disabilities. And this certainly occurred during some of the disasters surrounding 9/11. And you can find some instances of that when you look at larger scale disasters like Katrina. But you can also find lots of instances where people with disabilities were simply not treated appropriately. It certainly appears from the record that there were some individuals with disabilities in New Orleans who did not survive because they weren't treated appropriately. And that's extremely sad.
Henry Butler is a blind jazz and blues singer and keyboardist. He was born and raised in New Orleans and lost everything in Hurricane Katrina.
I lost most of the things that I owned, including the house. Had a wonderful place in the Gentilly section of New Orleans, which is near the lakefront. And when the levees broke, not only was water coming from Lake Pontchartrain, but the canals, which were near my house, broke as well. So we got it from two places. And when the waters rushed into my house, just like they did in other houses, it broke the windows out. And, I mean, nature is very, very powerful. I mean, we don't realize that until we're, faced with it, usually in disastrous situations. But when the waters came into the house, it smashed my dining room set and my dining room, and it turned much of my furniture upside down, including the refrigerators and the freezers. And by the time I got back to the house, the food was spewing out from when the storm hit. And that was, I didn't get back to my house until 4 months later. You can imagine the stench.
Oh, my goodness.
And the little bugs and little creatures, were all in the house looking for something to eat. I remember the second day that we were visiting the house, we apparently stayed there too long, and all kinds of things were scurrying and trying to get into the kitchen and then in the other room where the big freezer was. And we just quietly, after hearing some of that, we just quietly got out of there. But, it's a real challenge. It's tough after you lose everything, all of your whole wardrobe, all of your clothes, most of your records, your CDs, your tapes from that you've been dealing with for the last two or three decades, some recorded masters, some scores, musical scores, recording equipment. I lost practically everything in the recording studio, my piano, you name it. So we're still recovering from that, and we're doing okay. We're doing fine, but it's just going to take some time to really feel as comfortable as I've felt in the things that I owned and all that stuff before Katrina.
Now, were you at home when Katrina hit?
We knew how bad the storm was going to be, so we left a day before, and I brought about 4 or 5 changes of clothing with me, thinking that we might be able to get back to New Orleans, get back to my house. We thought there was a chance that it, meaning the storm, might sort of turn, like most storms had done in the past. We thought it might, you know, make a direction change, but it didn't.
We can divide an emergency preparedness, I think, into 5 segments, and I'd like to spend a little time talking about each of them. The first of them is kind of getting ready for a disaster. What should a community do in terms of being certain that people with disabilities are adequately included in planning for potential disasters? And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about earthquakes or tornadoes or hurricanes here. What matters is being certain that people with disabilities are included in the planning process for emergencies. And that has not often been the case. In fact, most of the time, emergency preparedness is handled by public officials and the Red Cross without a lot of public input, period, and with virtually no input from people with disabilities. Obviously, people with disabilities need themselves to become knowledgeable about some of the options that are out there. And there are some interesting issues that come up immediately. First, how do you identify people with disabilities? How do you know in any given community who the folks with disabilities are, where they are, what they want to do, whether they have family members, whether they plan to evacuate or to stay? What many communities are doing is they are developing voluntary registers where folks with disabilities can in fact register, and they can provide information about where they live and about what their desires are with regard to evacuation and how they want to be treated. Overall, that's an appropriate approach as long as it doesn't end up getting misused by the community. Sometimes, though, communities have essentially made this group of folks the very first to be evacuated and have essentially applied an awful lot of pressure to people with disabilities, indicating that they really need to be a part of this first evacuation group, and sometimes threatening people with disabilities in ways that they wouldn't threaten others. When we get to the post-emergency period, I'll be talking about what I consider some of the most difficult issues that are out there. One of the things that a disabled person has the right to do is to determine that he wishes to stay around during a disaster. And insofar as an individual who is not disabled has the right to make that choice, an individual with disabilities ought to be allowed to make that same choice. But often, such folks are not given those options, and instead are essentially pressured into going where the evacuation people tell them to go. I've been involved in several hurricanes and have never chosen to leave my house. That may be a foolhardy decision, but it's one that I choose to make. And so far I've survived, but there have been some real consequences surrounding that decision. So, with regard to the first one, as a chapter of ACB or as an individual, get involved in your community's emergency preparedness effort. Find out who's in charge. There'll usually be a Department of Emergency Disaster Management or Emergency Management. There'll usually be an official, even in a small town, who has the responsibility for handling that. Find out who it is, ask for, and demand that you see the plans for dealing with people with disabilities. I think you'll find that most of the time, people really haven't thought things through. In the Midwest, the primary way that citizens are warned of an impending disaster, and this particularly applies to a tornado, is by the use of a siren. That actually doesn't do deaf folks a lot of good. What alternatives exist in those small communities for assuring that deaf people know about tornadoes? Perhaps scrolling information at the bottom of a TV screen, but that too is a two-edged sword, because blind people can't see scrolling information on a TV screen, and it's crucial that it's recognized that you must have multimedia approaches to warning of impending disasters. You must also assure that you only send, and this is really getting on to the second component, which we'll describe perhaps as shelter. You have to assure that the shelters that you design include training in disability awareness. I think the most frightening things that I've seen in emergency preparedness have related to the degree to which disabled people who make a decision to go to a shelter and then find themselves turned away and told to go somewhere else. And usually they're told to go somewhere that's further away and somewhere that may or may not be appropriate. The real issue is that the folks within the shelters have no idea how to deal with folks with disabilities, because there's so much training that goes on in how to deal with ordinary folks that the needs of people with disabilities aren't simply not met. I've run across a number of instances where shelters have tried to separate service animals from their owners, where they've said, okay, you can stay, but you can't bring your, quote, pet. And there's just no understanding of service animals. Sometimes information is posted in shelters on bulletin boards. That information is absolutely inaccessible to people who are blind or visually impaired. Sometimes announcements are made over public address systems. People who are deaf have no idea what's being said and are excluded as well. And the general approach that's taken by disaster preparedness people is to say, well, we ought to create some special places for you people, and you shouldn't be considering going to just any old shelter. Well, frankly, as a blind person who functions pretty effectively, I don't see why I shouldn't consider going to any old shelter, and I think every old shelter needs to incorporate within it some accessibility features. We should not be using shelters that are not accessible to folks with disabilities. We should not be using shelters that don't, for instance, have an accessible path of travel to the door, that don't have accessible toileting facilities. We shouldn't really be setting up shelters that don't include some methods for dealing with transferring a person in a wheelchair onto a cot. We really shouldn't be using shelters that don't have access to something resembling a TTY for communicating with folks who are deaf. And part of what we need to do is to insist that we who are disabled are citizens as well, and that we need to be included, and that our needs need to be included in the planning of shelters. And particularly in communities where there are some choices, a community ought to be forced to look at the most accessible shelter rather than the one that seems to be the most convenient. Let me pause and see if anyone has questions or comments on this segment.
I think that that's true. I think that blind and disabled people need to be involved in forums that have to do with the civil safety and things of that nature in these forums. And we may need to, I think, make ourselves known at these forums so that they're aware of what we need and accessibility issues that we're concerned about. I'm wondering, is that why people would rather stay in their homes instead of going to a shelter because of that fact, Paul, that they're not as accessible?
That's not a factor for me, Gary. I just feel like I'm going to be as safe in my house as I'm going to be in a shelter, and I guess I'm just a stubborn old cuss with regard to that. I have gas, so I have hot water available even when the electricity goes off, and I have a gas stove and gas ovens, which means that I can actually cook without power. I think the scariest thing, though, is post-disaster, when there really has been a pretty significant disaster, is wondering what damage there is outside. Even if your house has survived well, and mine for the most part has, when the disaster is over, the real question is, what's it like outside? And there have been a lot of injuries and even deaths that have occurred for people with disabilities, not before or during a disaster, but actually after it's over. There was an absolutely horrid case right here in Miami, to give one example, where an individual chose to stay in his condo, and after everything was over, he walked out onto his balcony. This is an individual who was blind and had no idea that the railing on his balcony, which was 7 or 8 floors above the ground, had been broken away by the storm, and walked straight off his balcony to his death. And that's an indication of the kind of thing that can happen. But it's also an indication of one of the things that we need to recognize, and that is, how do people with disabilities get treated post-disaster? I think it's really important for people with disabilities to recognize that the community is going to be disrupted, and that particularly those who rely on paratransit need to recognize that it's pretty common for paratransit systems to take several days to get back up and running again. So even though people without disabilities can actually begin to get around because they can see and they can walk and they can drive, people with disabilities often don't have that luxury. That can mean lots of things. It can mean that people with disabilities may end up having to stay in shelters considerably longer than others do. But it can also mean that those people who are trapped in their homes don't get access to even the beginnings of relief nearly as soon as other people in the community. And somehow, we have to build into our disaster planning a recognition that there is a real need to provide contingency planning for after the storm for people with disabilities. I think the thing that bothered me the most is I recognize that I made the decision to stay in my house and that I therefore was obliged to deal with the bed that I'd chosen to lie in. But what bothered me the most was that once relief became available, like ice and food and other such things, to members of the general public who could drive and get it, I really felt that I had the right to at least be considered in receiving some of that assistance. And in fact, when I called and requested an opportunity to have some of those commodities delivered, or even more significantly, to have perhaps the police drive by my house to make sure that it was safe for me to leave it, what I was told was that as a disabled person, I was pretty low priority, and I'd chosen to stay there. If I'd gone to a shelter, they would have dealt with me, but since I chose not to, I shouldn't be expected to be catered to now. I don't think that my request was catering, and I think we have to build in to our disaster planning a recognition that the needs of people with disabilities need to be fairly carefully charted post-disaster to be certain that they actually get met. I have a real concern that right now people with disabilities get shunted to the bottom of the list, and we're made to seem the bad guys. Now, there are lots of other people who choose to stay in their homes, and after a hurricane or after a tornado or after an earthquake, those people who have chosen to stay are able to get out and get the things that they need or the help that becomes available. Folks with disabilities don't have that option, and as a result, regardless of what the community thinks of the decision they've made to stay in their homes, I believe they have some obligation to develop and implement a plan that places at least some kind of checking up on folks with disabilities fairly high on the priority list of things that should be done after a storm is over or after a disaster is over. So that's my view. So any thoughts on do disabled people have the right to expect to be treated in a way that would give them some priority in being checked on after a storm? Or if they decide to stay, do they forfeit all of their rights?
Well, I don't think that they should have to forfeit that. And it's unfortunate, like in Louisiana, where some of them lost their lives because of their disability, it seems like. But as I get older in years, it seems like, I don't know if I have a cynical view, that some people in the sighted world or the so-called non-disabled world think that we get a free ride too often, and I don't know, I disagree with that thing.
Yeah, I don't think that certainly what I'm proposing is a free ride, but I think there ought to be a recognition that people with disabilities are not going to be as able to be mobile after the storm, and the services on which they depend are probably going to be among the last things to get back up and running. And so there needs to be a plan to assure interim assistance for people with disabilities after the storm. So we've talked then about shelters, and we've talked about preparing for a storm. I think one of the things that we might want to talk about is what ought the expectations for people with disabilities to be. I would like to see every single chapter of the American Council of the Blind set up a telephone tree where people would be responsible for keeping in touch with each other between meetings. I think that's a good idea anyway, because it helps new members to feel like they're important and valued as part of an ACB chapter. But I think it's absolutely crucial at the time of disasters. And I think that each member of the chapter should be given the names of a couple of other people who it's expected that he or she will maintain contact with through a disaster, so that every member of our chapter will know where every other member is supposed to be and will do their best to keep in touch with those folks all the way through a disaster. I've been really fortunate. In none of the major disasters that I've lived through in my life have I been without a telephone. And that means that it's always been possible for me to keep in touch with others. And the telephone seems to be the one component that survives. Footnote 1, remember that you must have a wall or a non-cordless, non-electric telephone in your house. A lot of people are doing away with those and consider them very old-fashioned. But if you don't have a couple around in the event of a disaster, when the electricity goes off, your cordless phones will all die. So it's really crucial for people with disabilities to think about acquiring and maintaining possession of telephones that are the traditional ones that you just plug in to your telephone jack and it works. But because I've always had access to a telephone, I've always tried to maintain contact with many of the people I know. Many workplaces now require managers to retain a set of emergency phone numbers for all the people who work in their department and to call those folks after a disaster. And I think that's a really appropriate and compassionate way to operate, and I think it's the way that we as disabled people need to be treating each other as well. So I think another of the things that we ought to seriously consider is being sure that we maintain a log of all of our members and all of our friends and actively seek to be in touch with them after disasters happen to make sure they're okay. On a couple of occasions when we've lost track of people, we've actually had reason to believe, therefore, that they were in trouble. And we've actually called authorities, and on a couple of occasions, we're actually able to help someone. We had a member who was diabetic and who got really out of control after a disaster and ended up being in a coma. And probably if we had not been in contact with authorities and asked them to go and look at his situation, he might not have survived. So I think that those telephone trees can be of immense importance. One of the things we haven't talked about is medication. There's a Murphy's Law that says when a disaster happens, you're going to be almost out of medication. Try not to let that happen, especially if you live in an area where disasters can happen. Recognize that you really do need to be sure that at any given time you have about 2 weeks' worth of medication. Many of us actually get our medication by post. Some of us have to get to drugstores. And the probability is huge that even if the time of the disaster isn't all that long, it's going to be a week, sometimes even 10 days, before stores end up being open that you're accustomed to dealing with, before the paratransit system that you use is going to be up and running. And so it's really important for everyone to recognize that if they need medication to stay healthy, they need to always assure that they have at least 2 weeks of that medication on hand. And if your medication needs refrigeration, you also need to assure that you have and maintain lots of ice. One of the things that I do when a disaster is impending is I find containers that I think will work, and I stuff my freezer with as many of those containers full of water as I can manage. It has two effects. The first one is it enables my freezer to survive a lot longer than it otherwise might in terms of its food and what I have to throw away. But more important, it allows me to have areas where I can keep things like medication cold if I need to. So that's another thing that's pretty cool. I guess five or six other specific things that I would say about folks who are blind. Be sure that you have recorded in several different places all the numbers that you might need. Not only phone numbers for relatives and friends, but also bank account numbers and insurance policy numbers and medication numbers, prescription numbers. Even if you have to hire someone to help you to get those prepared, I think it's really crucial that you do that. It is suggested that one of the things that everybody does is as a preparation for disaster is to acquire a watertight, well-protected box of some sort into which important papers can be put. And if you don't have one of those right now, I would urge all of you to acquire one and to put at least one copy of the kind of information that I'm talking about in a format that you can use into that entity. Now, some of you are going to say, well, I don't read Braille and I can't read large print and without a CCTV. Well, most of us who are blind can hear recordings. So if you end up having to put this information on a mini cassette recorder with a mini cassette, do it. The bottom line is you really need to have access to all of the information about you when you need it especially at the time of a disaster.
Paul, that sounds like a good idea. You'd mentioned, though, about the having a phone that you can plug in. I was wondering, though, what about my brother has a place down in Florida, but he doesn't have a regular phone. He just has a cell phone. That maybe not relate to my situation, but I was wondering, you say not have, it's maybe not good to have a handheld necessarily or just a phone that's not plugged in, but what about cell phones?
Gary, the answer is no. Part of the problem, and of course it depends on the disaster, in California when there are serious earthquakes, one of the entities that may well go down are cell phone towers. And in tornadoes, cell phone towers, and with hurricanes, cell phone towers are among the first things to disappear. So it's really crucial that you not depend solely on a cell phone. We're probably getting closer and closer to the time where there are lots of folks who are going to be in that situation where the only phone that they have, period, is a cell phone. One of the reasons that I haven't converted to internet telephony is precisely for this reason. I want to be able to have a phone for as long as the landlines survive. In many communities now, telephone lines are underground in a lot of areas and are therefore pretty well protected. The same thing applies to cable. Much of cable is often underground and it survives. Sometimes it doesn't. I mean, clearly you're still using transformers and connecting stations for cable, which often get damaged at the time of serious disasters. But thinking that the cell phone is going to function effectively post-disaster is not necessarily accurate. So a cell phone is not usually the best substitute for having a real old-fashioned landline connection to your house. Most disasters have demonstrated that those landline phones survive the best. So we have four or five final thoughts that I want to be sure that I cover before I end this dissertation tonight that you guys have been forced to listen to because my guest didn't turn up. The first of the things that I want everyone to remember, and that we haven't so far really talked about except tangentially, is that the disaster plan of your community needs to include service animals, and every shelter needs to provide specific training to the folks in a shelter about how to deal with service animals. Particularly people who are blind and visually impaired need to be sure that they have sufficient food that they can take for their dog, and any medications that their service animal needs should be carried with them. But there ought to be an expectation that that service animal can be accommodated in the shelter, and that a relief area plan has been made for that dog. And it may be appropriate for the shelter to say to a person who's blind or visually impaired, if it becomes necessary, that there's someone in the shelter who is extremely sensitive to dogs, and therefore he or she may be asked to avoid that person and to, in general, stay away from individuals who may be sensitive to dogs. But there should be plans incorporated that absolutely encourage the inclusion of service animals. One of the big differences, by the way, between Katrina and now is pets were actually incorporated into evacuation plans so that an individual didn't have to make the wrenching choice of whether to go and be safe and leave his pets or her pets behind to die, or whether to evacuate along with pets. So pets, in fact, were included in evacuation plans for New Orleans this year, and that was a huge step forward. So service animals is number one. Number two, we get what we demand. It's absolutely essential that people with disabilities recognize that in their area, their disaster preparedness plans will not include the kinds of things that will assure the safety and comfort of people with disabilities until and unless people with disabilities become a major component of disaster planning. It is absolutely crucial that you and your local chapter become involved in the disaster planning effort. Without your input, you can be sure your community will do it wrong. Number three, it is absolutely essential that disaster plans be evaluated. Now, there are often drills for disaster plans, but very often the needs of people with disabilities aren't a part of the evaluation process for disasters. When you're involved in being sure that disabled people know about disasters, being sure that shelters are ready for people with disabilities, being sure that disabled people are included in post-disaster planning, you also need to be sure that the needs of disabled people are incorporated into the evaluation of the performance of disasters. It's absolutely crucial that people with disabilities recognize that, again, unless you demand it, you're not going to be high priority in terms of evaluation. One of the things that we've done with drills at the place where I work is to incorporate this as a component, to actually look at how we did with people with disabilities and to be sure that we, in fact, do a better job. And I actually admire the institution I work for their decision. It's a Miami-Dade College is a big college, but we actually do make sure not only that people with disabilities are incorporated into our emergency evacuation plans and know about them, we also make sure that after an emergency evacuation drill has occurred, we look at how we did with people with disabilities as well, and your communities need to do that. Finally, as a thought, I guess I'd like to make this point. People with disabilities are citizens of the United States and are residents of communities. In fact, whether they're citizens or not, as long as we are a part of communities, we have the right to be considered. We often take the position that we should do what we're told and behave like nice little disabled people because, after all, people are making a special effort to look after us. Well, I am not one of those disabled people who wants to be looked after. I want to be able to look after myself, and I want to be able to look after myself in the least restrictive environment and in the most appropriate and effective way. And if that means fighting City Hall, and if that means fighting the Red Cross in order to get both to incorporate the kinds of things we've been talking about this evening into emergency preparedness planning, that's not a problem for me. I absolutely believe and will continue to believe that the primary reason why disabled people don't get more of what they want and need is because disabled people choose not to ask for it in appropriate and effective ways. If you take one thing away from this program tonight, I hope that what that will be is that unless you get involved and tell your community what it is that you as people with disabilities need, you shouldn't expect to get it because you won't. The truth is that even though you have powerful documents from the Department of Justice that now help you to convince your communities that the needs of people with disabilities need to be included in disaster preparedness planning, until and unless you start using those documents, until and unless you actually push them into the face of your community and send them kicking and biting towards compliance, you're not going to get anywhere. And I need to tell all of you that neither the Red Cross nor your communities are happy about many of the provisions that are incorporated in these Department of Justice comments. In case some of you tuned in late, what I started the program off by telling folks about is a really cool resource that I would encourage all of you to take a look at. And this resource is located at www.ada.gov. And as I said at the beginning, there are a number of documents that relate to emergency preparedness, but the one that I would urge all of you to use is part of an ADA toolkit that the Department of Justice has developed for state and local governments. Chapter 7 and the most recently developed chapter of these documents relates to emergency preparedness. It includes a number of checklists, and it also includes a chapter that provides lots of information about the way that the community should deal with folks with disabilities at times of disasters. And I would encourage every single one of you to bring it up at your next chapter meeting. What are you doing about disaster preparedness in your community? Particularly those of you who don't live in hurricane areas or tornado areas or earthquake areas. You're the guys whose communities are likely to have the least well-developed plans. And so it's really especially important for you to get in among the community planners and make sure that the needs of people with disabilities are in fact included in the plans that they make. That website again, www.ada.gov. If you have some comments or concerns about what we've discussed tonight, aside from the fact that you've had to hear me for far too much of the time because my guests didn't turn up, please feel free to send me an email at TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Thank you very much, everyone, for your participation, and thanks to Gary Wood, one of our most faithful listeners, for putting up with me for the last hour. I do appreciate all of you listening, and appreciate in particular the opportunity to talk a little bit about a topic that I'm very concerned about. Remember, the biggest disaster that can happen to a person with disabilities is the disaster of not being prepared. So, like all good Boy Scouts, be prepared, be involved, and be safe.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.